When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game and really doesn't function well in the heat. I'm Kevin Day and he is the coolest man on the planet, Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. Seriously, Kieran, if it's this hot on Saturday before the Palace game, I may have to drink something other than Guinness.
Me.
I'm sorry, you may notice we're both a bit giggly. It's because we've had a 10-minute childish boys gossip session before we started. Guy, put some ice on your ears, it'll be fine. It's news day, Kieran, and speaking of shenanigans in the heat, extraordinary scenes at the start of the Brazil-Argentina game when a couple of Brazilian health officials, obviously enjoying themselves very much, marched onto the pitch and stopped the match.
Yes, spectacular work from the clipboard kids in Brazil. They really have surpassed themselves with regards to not allowing the Argentinian players to play. A lot of politics involved in South American sport. But I think there's a much broader issue arising here with relating to COVID and club versus country versus FIFA in terms of power broking.
What will the financial ramifications be? Because presumably there will be some.
Well, as the match was abandoned, it could be that there'll have to be a rebate given to the TV authorities. The commercial sponsors will be cheesed off. FIFA normally gives some form of financial recompense as to national associations for clubs and players. So we'll have to wait and see. But it does look as if FIFA have now started to take it up with the clubs, who not relating to the players who actually physically turned up, because they appeared to have turned up, the Argentinian players turned up without permission of their clubs, but for those players where the Premier League had flexed its muscles and said that they were not going to be able to attend. So what we've now seen is FIFA have turned round and says, well, hold on, we are the governing body of football. You cannot, as the Premier League, make a unilateral rule and forbid players from representing their country, as appears to have been the case. And therefore, it has invoked a ban on the players for 5 days, which will mean that I think Leeds, Manchester City and Liverpool in particular will be unable to play players such as Alisson and Ederson in this weekend's fixtures.
Well, this is where the politics comes into it, as you say, because Brazil apparently put pressure on FIFA for that to happen. But Richarlison will be playing for Everton because Brazil said we don't mind Richarlison playing because Everton let him play for us during the Olympics, which already there's an exception to the rule. But just in terms of finances, Kieran, which is obviously what we're here to concentrate on, you say that the Villa and Spurs players went without permission of their club, but notwithstanding that, there's a very clear Premier League diktat that no Premier League players were to go to red list countries. And two players from Villa and two from Spurs did exactly that. So will there be a fine, a financial penalty for those two clubs, even if they claim they didn't know the players were doing it? And also, if the players acted so clearly in breach of their contracts, will they not be fined by the clubs as well?
I think this one has got some legal ramifications. The PFA might decide that as far as the players were concerned, they were entitled to represent their nation, and therefore the clubs trying to prevent them would mean that the clubs would be in breach of contract. So if the clubs try to fine the players, I can see the players' representatives turning around and saying, well, that's not acceptable. Now, how far they decide to take this, because remember, the players want to play for the clubs as well, because they're on bonuses for appearances and so on. So it could get very narky between the two parties. The Premier League conceivably could fine the clubs who for not having control of their players, but that in itself seems very harsh. You know, if you or I are in employment, what we do in our own time is to a large extent, you know, down to our decision making process rather than that of our employer. And you know what you do in your own time is your own business, and how can they be expected to be acting in a big brother format, especially during an international break?
Yeah, I'm doing most of my work from home at the moment, Kieran, so it's very much down to me how I use my time. mainly 2 hours of panic at the end of the day. And also, it's not helped, is it, this situation? If it was Brazil and any other club, or Argentina and any other club, but these are two countries that will waste no opportunity to snipe at each other, will they?
No, there is history. You know, they both of them see themselves as the top dog of South American football, and with the Argentinian players appearing to be in breach of Brazilians' COVID rules, it gave them a perfect opportunity. I mean, the timing was spectacularly crass. So why they allowed the players to effectively to line up before making this grandstanding ban is it's superb nonsense in some ways, and we like nonsense in football.
Yes, we do. And just so we don't disappoint some of our more childish fans, Kieran, would you like to throw in a Manscaped Brazilian reference? domestic matters, Kieran, and a couple of clubs that have been on our list for some time, one more so than another, but let's hold them back for the moment. Bolton Wanderers have avoided EFL sanctions and a transfer embargo 2 years after the takeover by Football Ventures.
Yes, under the EFL rules, and I think these rules do make a lot of sense. You have to settle when there's a takeover of a club that's been in administration. You've got to settle all of your football debts, and football debts are amounts owed in terms of transfers and to players and other such institutions. But you then have people who are referred to as unsecured creditors. These are people and companies who have supplied the football club in good faith with goods and services. Now, under general legislation, they could end up getting nothing. They could end up getting something. You know, it's because there's no other way of divvying up the money. Under the football rules of the EFL, you've got to pay your unsecured creditors 25% of what is owed to them within 2 years. And that two-year anniversary was rapidly approaching. So it looks as if Football Ventures have found the money, and they found it by the end of August 2021, because the alternative was a potential 15-point penalty, clearly, which the club was desperate to avoid. The unanswered question is, how have they found that money?
Yeah.
Has the money been borrowed? Football Ventures have put out a sort of fairly detailed explanation. They say that the club is not at risk. I believe that some of the money has been borrowed, and yeah, I've always said there's nothing wrong with debt. It's servicing the debt and making sure that you have sufficient resources to make the payments on the due dates. That's the issue. So we have to take Football Ventures' comments in good faith. Bolton have a very big fan base. Yeah, they've made They made a pretty impressive start to the season in terms of the numbers of people who are attending, and they take huge numbers away as well. So that's where we are. Fingers crossed that the club does continue to progress, because they went through a really torrid time under the former owner, Ken Anderson, a man who was previously banned from being a director of any company in the UK for, I think, a period of around about 7 years. He used to boast that he never paid himself a salary, and that boast is entirely correct. However, both he and his son extracted large sums of money from the club via consultancy fees, which I think is indicative of the nature of the man. And I'm not going to call him a wrong one, mainly due to the fact that I don't want producer guy to get into a panic.
Yeah, let's not be cynical about this, Kieran. Even I know the difference between a salary and a consultancy fee that's paid on a regular annual basis into your private bank account. So that's good news, Kieran, for one team in white shirts and dark blue shorts. Less good news, I'm afraid, for another team in white shirts and dark blue shorts. And you know where we're heading, Kieran. We're on that road again to the East Midlands. You and I might as well just move there. Actually, there's no logic to that, is there, Kieran, in these days of the internet? Not 2 weeks ago, Kieran, you told me that Derby County and the EFL have had a rapprochement. They're talking again. And now I'm told by Guy and his half-arsed script. I think Guy may have been drinking this week when he sent the script. But now I'm told that a fifth charge has been added to Derby's crime sheet. That's not the good news that we were talking about 2 weeks ago, Kieran, is it?
No. I mean, I think the chat we had 2 weeks ago was broadly on the lines of, can the dispute between Derby and the EFL, and for EFL, read most of the other clubs in the Championship, can that be resolved without having to go through a formal charge and defence procedure, which could be very time-consuming and costly? The EFL, whom we are trying to have a good relationship with these days.
Yes.
One
of them anyway.
Yes. If they carry on saying things like that, if they want to encourage journalists to not talk to me, that's their prerogative. Not that I'm sore about it. But the issue here is that the EFL now has on the governance part of its website an embargoes page. And this is great. I'm all for transparency. And there are currently 12 charges against a variety of clubs throughout the 72 clubs in the EFL. Five of those charges relate to Derby County. Right. And it was historically that they'd not provided accounts, they'd not published accounts, there were defaults of money due to the tax authorities, they'd not submitted audited accounts as well. And then, lo and behold, a few days ago, up pops another issue, is that they, according to the charge, or according to the issue here, is that they are in default of transfer fee payments. And people might be saying to themselves, hold on, they've not been able to sign any players for a transfer fee because they're under a transfer embargo. But I suspect that this relates to the fact that they have historically bought players on an instalment basis. So it could be that some of the instalments due on outstanding transfers have not been paid. And the club, which was due receipt, has presumably contacted and complained to the EFL. And this has brought a further appearance on the naughty step of the EFL, and you can understand that because it's a football debt. The club sold the player in presumably in good faith and was expecting the payments to be received on the due dates.
Was that a naughty step sound effect you did there?
Naughty step stroke wonky chomp. sound effect I would describe it as. Yes,
that was a big wonky jump. One day we should start explaining. We should do notes for new listeners, shouldn't we, really?
Yes.
If they're going to confuse them. Do you know what, Kieran? We joke about the amount of times we mentioned Derby County, but we have been talking about them since the second or third pod, and it's relentlessly bad news for Derby. And I'm starting to worry that there's no light at the end of this tunnel, is there, at the moment for Derby County? Is there any glimmer of hope you can give to Derby fans at all?
Well, they haven't had a points deduction. They still are in the Championship. They have made a reasonable start to the season with the players that they were allowed to recruit. So I think those are positives. I think I've said myself that the best way to negotiate the sale of the club is to keep it private. And the mistakes that they've made in terms of the Middle East takeover and the Eric Alonso.
Didn't
paint the club in a particularly good light. If you're going to do a deal, just get it done, sign off on the paperwork, get it approved, and then take the plaudits. Unfortunately, the issues. Mel Morris has underwritten substantial losses. It's clear that he wants out. I think some of the steps which he's taken have not necessarily painted him in a particularly positive manner. And of course, there are other clubs in the Championship and elsewhere in the EFL who are unhappy at what they perceive as Derby getting away with it, but they've successfully defended the charges to date.
Mm. Well, if Derby are the Championship club we mentioned most, at the moment Newcastle United are the Premier League club we mentioned most, and they've issued a statement to fans explaining their summer transfer window strategy. It's a bit of an odd one, this, Kieran, isn't it?
Yes. In terms of Newcastle, they signed Joe Willock, for £20 million. There are clubs that had a lower spend. But this is a classic case of lies, damned lies and statistics. The publication of this statement on the club website said, this is how much money we've spent since, I think it was January 2019. And indeed, they have spent some money since then. But if you take a look at the If you go back a further couple of years, they spent nothing or next to nothing. So the trouble with numbers when you're making a quotation, it all depends on when you start and when you finish. And Newcastle's investment in player recruitment has been modest. It's not the bottom of clubs in the Premier League, and I want to stress that. But I think their claims that all good now, we're splashing the cash, is a little manipulated in terms of the chosen dates. But again, I've said this: if you were selling something, the last thing you're going to do before you leave is stick in a new kitchen and give the whole house a lick of paint, because somebody else is going to benefit from that. And Mike Ashley has been in the process of selling Newcastle United, or trying to sell Newcastle United now for 2 or 3 years. And therefore, his mentality is, what is the bare minimum I can get away with until that sale date? Because every pound I spend is a pound wasted. Provided his objective is to finish 17th in the Premier League each season, he'll point out that last season they finished 12th, and therefore, why are people moaning? Because he has lost interest in Newcastle United. That is fairly evident, especially if you take a look at the infrastructure spend at the club, and he wants all of those costs to be picked up by the new owner.
Well, I was about to pick up on that infrastructure cost and the lick of paint comment, as you say, because we've seen several threads recently from Newcastle fans with umpteen photographs of shabby bits of St James's Park. I believe the same pigeon has been there for 2 years.
Yes.
Dead, by the way, not just patient. Not just patient. But so, yeah, we've seen a number of those. So it's quite clear he's not spending money on what is a brilliant, iconic ground. But yesterday, Kieran, I noticed hashtag Newcastle takeover was trending mightily. Was that because of a tweet that you sent about Saudi ownership of a Newcastle-based company?
I did find that something had changed with regards to a I think it's called NUSA investments or something similar. And there does appear that company is now directly controlled by Saudi PIF Public Investment Fund. Whether you can then take a leap of faith, and I think it would have to be a leap of faith to say that there is progress with regards to the Newcastle takeover, I think is probably pushing it. It was just a, you know, I monitor 200 or 300 companies, you know, not just the football clubs themselves, but the clubs that own the football clubs and quite often the people that own the clubs that own the football clubs. Yeah, so I try to get as much data as we can. So something has changed. Can we draw any conclusions from this? I don't think so. It could be linked to another investment of this particular entity. So unfortunately for the purposes of Newcastle fans, I can't offer you any comfort. Is it a change? Yes. Is change the same as improvement in terms of chances of the takeover? No.
Leicester City have rolled over their loan from an Australian bank that you've never been particularly fond of.
What many clubs are doing. Sheffield United had got a similar relationship. This is a bank called Macquarie, known as the Vampire Kangaroo, due to I think it's fair to say that its ethical and moral compass is not necessarily pointing north in terms of some of the deals it's had historically. Let's be honest, banks aren't interested in football. Banks are interested in making money. There's nothing wrong with that, but if anybody wants to investigate further, just look up Macquarie and Vampire Kangaroo and Goldman and Vampire Squid, and you see the...
Can I just double check here? They don't call themselves the Vampire Kangaroo, do they? Because that would be ballsy branding, wouldn't it?
Yeah, in fact, for Australians, I think I'm surprised that they don't call themselves that, because given the lack of subtlety in sort of Aussie branding, I think it's the way to go. I think it irks them slightly to be called that. So that's why I keep calling them that. I wasn't the first person to call them that. So I'm not smart enough. But the nature of what we have here, and some people will get upset. It's a glorified form of payday loan, in the sense that football clubs have guaranteed money coming in at future dates from the Premier League in terms of their entitlement to broadcast revenues, if the worst happens, also parachute payments. So what happens is the bank says you are due to receive a minimum of, say, 60 million this summer, 20 million in December, another 20 million in March. Tell you what, we'll give you a sizable amount of that now. And when you get the money from the Premier League, you just transfer that straight across to us. Mm-hmm. So, this is the official name for this is invoice factoring, or some middle management blue sky weekend away term. But it's the equivalent of a payday loan. In the sense that you've got money coming in at the future, and you use that, get that guaranteed revenue to generate a loan now. Nothing wrong with it. Benefits in terms of cash flow. Leicester have invested in their infrastructure. Yeah, they're expanding the stadium. They've got absolutely superb training facilities set up. So that has to be funded from somehow. So that's the nature of the relationship. But we are seeing more and more of these types of borrowing, because the conventional banks are a bit twitchy about lending to football clubs, because if the loan starts to turn a bit sour, if you're the local branch manager of you know, Lloyds or Barclays and so on, you become public enemy number one if you try to call in the loan with the fan base. If you're one of these types of banks, you know, international investment banks, then they've got the cojones which are made of steel. You know, they are bulletproof. They simply don't care. They just want the money.
This episode of The Price of Football is brought to you by The Price of Football online course, hosted by our very own Kieran Maguire. Kieran, tell us more.
Well, Kevin, it's some friends of mine who couldn't afford the Swiss Ramble. So therefore, they decided instead to create the Price of Football course. So it's a 6-week online course starting on the 20th of September, and it's been designed for anybody who wants to potentially get a career in the football industry through a combination of quality education, but also networking. It's really important that you get to know people in the industry because it is a small industry. So it includes 6 hours of weekly study material and a 90-minute mentoring session every week on topics like governing bodies, clubs and investors. I might manage to sneak a bit about amortization in about it as well. So they've asked me to be one of the tutors. So you will see me, or perhaps hear me, or failing that, perhaps they'll see and hear Finlay. And you'll also get the option to attend the World Football Summit in Madrid, though I suspect that will be virtually.
It sounds wonderful, Kieran. It does sound genuinely interesting. And a very good way to launch your career. I also like the fact that you're more likely to be tutored by Finlay than you are by me. if you are listening to this and you'd like to launch your career in the football industry with Kieran, who better, let's face it, to help launch your career in the football industry, head to www.sportstalentnetwork.com for more information.
And I also believe you can get an early bird 33% discount at the moment. So go to www.sportstalentnetwork.com to sign up, and perhaps I'll see you on the course, and Finlay as well.
A number of small businesses, Kieran, self-employed people, comedians, in short-term need of money, will go to the bank and say, can you help me? I've got these jobs coming up, this guaranteed income. And of course, what the bank does is then they ask your agent or they ask the production company you're working for to give them some proof that you are, in fact, going to be earning this money.
Yeah.
Would a vampire kangaroo bank ask the Premier League? Would they double check that this is the amount of money that they will be getting at a certain date? Or is the Premier League such a reputable name that the bank just go, well, of course they're getting that money?
If you take a look at the paperwork involved in these documents, normally there is a letter which gets sent to the Premier League, which effectively says, yeah, we now have this relationship between Leicester City and Macquarie, or it could be Santander, or it could be another institution. The Premier League is fine with it. I mean, yeah, the Premier League is a copper-bottomed organisation in the sense that it's got these long-term broadcasting arrangements which have guaranteed sums of money.
Well, okay. It takes a lot of doing this, Kieran, but Oldham's owners have managed to alienate their fan base even further. And we saw a lot of tweets about this, Kieran. I decided it was prudent to not follow my usual practice of liking every tweet I get. Because on second reading, some of them probably, I understand the sentiment, didn't necessarily approve of the wording. But yes, it's taken a sadder twist to the Oldham story, hasn't it? And again, I worry that suddenly this Oldham story has really gathered a momentum that it didn't have 2 weeks ago.
Yes. There has been an open letter on the club website from Abdallah Lentzegam, the former agent who acquired Oldham Athletic when I think they were in League One at the time, with the claim that I'm going to take you to the Championship. I'm going to get you out of this division. Well, the second part of that claim has sadly been proven to be correct, and the club's in genuine danger of dropping out of the EFL. They made a pretty appalling start to the season. It's been really tough for Keith Curl to recruit players because they are also under sort of, you know, broad observation by the EFL with regards to their finances. Abdallah Lentzegam, he's got through nine managers in 4 years. Paul Scholes was briefly there, and Paul Scholes for people that, that aren't aware, as you know, grew up as an Oldham Athletic fan. You know, he's from that part of Manchester. Have I told you the story when we played cricket against Scholes when he was 15?
No.
Oh right, yeah, he was. We were playing in the South Lancashire League, and our opening batsman had
Who's we, Kieran?
I used to play for Trafford.
Oh, okay.
Our opening bat had got to 199 not out in the final over. Nobody in the history of the South Lancashire League had ever scored a double century because it was a 40 over match, and he pushed a ball out into the covers and was raising his bat. We were all, you know, everybody was cheering him from the observation posts, you know, from dotted around the ground, and Scholes ran in from cover and threw down the stumps whilst the bat was in the air and ran him out from 199. And we, of course, wet ourselves laughing. but that's indicative of the competitive nature of Paul Scholes, even at the age of 15. And he was a damn good cricketer as well, but United... United then said, "Paul, okay, we're not going to allow you to play cricket anymore."
That's a brilliant story. I was rather hoping it ended with Paul Scholes taking him out of the knee and then doing that innocent look while the commentator said, "Well, he's not that sort of player normally." Yes, he is every second game.
Why take one vacation with the family when you could take all of them? With Royal Caribbean, you don't just go to the beach. You visit a private island and race down the tallest water slide in North America. You don't just go for a road trip. You ATV and zip line through the jungle. You don't just go somewhere new. You rappel down waterfalls and discover ancient temples. Because this isn't just any vacation. This is all the vacations. Come seek the Royal Caribbean. Ships Registry, Bahamas.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
There's also a bunch of Oldham fans called the Athleticos, who are, you know, similar to the Ultras, that you've got a Palace and we could see at other clubs, and they're trying to make more noise and try to give the club support, but they've not been impressed with Mr. Lempsagam, and they've had a number of banners. But those banners and flags have now been banned by the club. As a result of that, the Athleticos have said, "Well, if you want to be like that, we're going to boycott attending the club." And it did mean that apparently, when I think they played at the weekend and lost 4-0 or 5-0 at home, there were other flags and banners from non-Athleticos. So there was a pitch. There'd been pitch invasions. The fan base are very concerned, and I believe that in this open letter, Lempsagam has said that he's keen to open a dialogue, and he's doing all of these positive things. His brother effectively runs the club, sort of more on a day to day basis. And I think his brother was in the director's box and got a lot of abuse. And what I'd always say to fans is keep on the right side of things, because you can get an awful lot of public support. You know, be smart in the way. You know, the lobbing of tennis balls onto the pitch. Yeah, that's great. I think Charlton fans did the same with rubber ducks. You know, come up with schemes which will win you the public relations war. I've been involved in pitch invasions when we had problems at Brighton back in the mid 90s. My first knowledge of you in terms of football was when you did a benefit gig for my club. And, you know, I'll be honest, you know, for a Palace fan to do a benefit gig for the club that he hates is, you know, I still, my hat is still permanently doffed to you in that. I've chased our former chief executive around Chester car park when I saw him before a match along with a series of expletives, and I shouldn't have done that particular one because that would not have ended well if I had caught him. That's the nature of football. Is a very emotional game. You know, my advice to the Oldham fans: keep it smart, keep it funny, keep it idiosyncratic, but still make sure that the owners are aware that they are unhappy, the fans are unhappy with the way that the club is being run at present. You're more likely to get support from, you'll get support from other fans, yeah, regardless. But if you want to get support from the media, just, you know, the smart things tend to go down well, because it's a story that the media will pick up on.
Yeah, and as far as I'm concerned, the fans already occupy the moral high ground, so just stay there. Basically, that's half the battle won. It's interesting, that picture, though. We did the 5-year plan podcast yesterday, and I won't bore you with the context, but we ended up discussing fans taking direct action and going on the pitch. And I was the oldest person on yesterday's panel by quite some time, and the three other young people went, "No, I've never been on the pitch. I can't imagine any situation where you'd go on the pitch unless you're a mascot. No, that's terrible." Right? I was just sitting there going, "Do do 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 do."
Yes.
There was a time in the '80s I spent more time on the pitch than off it. So that's Oldham. The co-chairman of Barnsley, Paul Conway, has claimed that his club is one of the few who don't bend financial fair play rules. Is he making a general point here? Is he specifically taking aim at clubs he doesn't like? Why has he felt the need to say this at this time, Kieran?
Paul Conway, he doesn't talk to the media that often. But when he does, he gets his guns lined up and he starts lobbing them, starts lobbing the bullets. So he started off with an assessment of the Home Office, which he described as a joke, and Amateur Hour, which is one of my favourite singles of all time by Sparks. And anybody knows what that song's about, we won't go down that particular rabbit hole. With regards to visa delays for players that Barnsley were recruiting, Barnsley are using an analytics and money ball style approach, I believe, to player recruitment. And then he turned his attention to financial fair play. Now, in a couple of years ago, he threatened to sue the EFL if there were not points deductions for Birmingham City, Sheffield Wednesday, and another club in the Championship at the time, whose name I forget, but may play in white shirts and dark shorts. But that didn't appear to come to anything. And he has said that the present FFP rules allow clubs to cheat due to a lack of enforcement. And he compared the Championship to La Liga. I've got to be honest here. I don't think it's a case of they're allowed to cheat. The EFL has limited resources. You know, it can't afford a team of, he said, you know, look at La Liga. La Liga have got 20 accountants who are constantly monitoring the spending and the budgets of football clubs. Well, the EFL doesn't have the money to do that, and that's, you know, if you can't afford a policeman, crime will be committed. On a broader thing, he also was. He was saying that the average wage in the Championship is around about 15 grand a week. That ties in with my figures. But Barnsley, they're paying 5k a week, and they're broadly trying to break even. He says, yeah, why aren't other clubs doing the same? It's because the club owners want to get into the Premier League, and they know that by spending money, that's one way of achieving that objective. So I'm not defending the approach taken by other owners, but that's That's where they're coming from. They know it's football's a talent game, and if you pay to the talent, you increase your chances. But there's no guarantee, of course, because only three clubs can go up. But you know, if you take a look at the Championship this summer, there's eight clubs who did not pay any transfer fees at all for new players. Yeah, they've relied on loans, Bosmans, academy players, players out of contract, and so on.
Mm. I've never had you down as a Sparks fan, Kieran, I have to say.
Oh, love Sparks.
Yeah, I couldn't take
them. Yeah, very, very arty.
Yeah, I didn't mind that particular song because it had a very clever rhyme for Yehudi Menuhin, who, as all our listeners will know, was a world-famous violinist in the 70s and 80s, and the subject of one of my favourite jokes at the time, Eric Morecambe saying, what's happened to your violin? I'm have to use the old one because I gave Yehudi Menuhin. that's just for you, Martin Searle. The FAs of Bangladesh, the Maldives, Nepal, and Sri Lanka have all come out in favour of a World Cup every 2 years. And I noticed that Gareth Southgate this week said he wouldn't particularly be against it. Why has this idea suddenly gained traction just in the last week or so? Why would the FIFA want a biannual World Cup? Money, presumably, but...
The original suggestion came from the Saudi Arabian Football Association, who are very keen to host the World Cup at some point in the future. Now, if you think that we've got the World Cup, FIFA World Cup, taking place in Qatar in 2022, realistically, I don't think it would be... We're probably talking 2040, before it's likely to return to, you know, the Middle East area. Mm. So you can see that from the Saudi perspective, you know, that is potentially too long a period to wait. If we take a look at these countries that have come out in favour of the World Cup taking place every 2 years, I don't think it's harsh to say that their chances of qualifying for the finals are not great, even in an expanded competition. You know, we're potentially moving to a 48-nation competition. If you take a look at their FIFA rankings, they'd still be punching above their weight if they did qualify. So why are they so keen? Well, if you take a look at FIFA's finances, it loses money 3 years out of every four, and the fourth just happens to be when the FIFA World Cup takes place. If anybody can remember who won the Confederations Cup in 2017, they're a better person than I. Offhand, I do know it, of course, because I'm a nerd.
So do I, Kieran. But for the benefit of those people listening, Spain?
I think it was Germany.
Oh, Germany. Okay.
Yeah. But the FIFA distribute money to all of its member nations on an annual basis, and that distribution includes a bonus. Normally, if they've had a profitable World Cup year.
Yeah,
so if they've now got a competition which is going to be profitable 1 year in every two as opposed to 1 year in every four, there's a lot of money now going to, you know, the Maldives, Nepal, the Cook Islands, and so on. So you can see why these smaller nations, it's in their interests as well as the interests of the likes of Saudi Arabia, who want to host the World Cup, for it to take place on a more regular basis. So we've seen Arsene Wenger now make this suggestion, along with effectively having the internationals taking place twice a year. Whether that would be over a 2 week or 3 week period, you might have one in October and one in March, which is solely devoted to internationals, and the rest of the year is allocated to club football. We know football players are well remunerated, but there's in danger of killing the goose which lays the golden eggs, which is the talent. When exactly are they supposed to have a break? Mm. Because at present, we've got the Euros taking place every 4 years, the World Cup taking place every 4 years. If you've now got a World Cup taking place on a 2 year basis, you've also got the Confederations Cup the year before the World Cup. You've got FIFA wanting an expanded World Club Championship taking place as well. The players are going to, they're not animals that you can just break the backs of. And regardless of how much they're paid, that they are professional athletes. Don't try to extract the last piece of money out of them through having more and more fixtures. So the fixture list has to be looked at. And what do we have up on the horizon? We've got an expanded Champions League with more matches taking place, so domestically, internationally. It's a mess.
Of course, if you have a World Cup every 2 years, Kieran, then that's double the amount of countries that you need to host, which is double the amount of schmoozing money for FIFA from those countries who want the World Cup.
I would never say that FIFA is a mafia organization riddled with corruption and former executives who have been banned from the game, because that would be wrong. Because that would imply that they might be financially benefiting from such things in the future. And we all know that the Russian and the Qatar World Cups were chosen for football reasons.
If you would never say that, Kieran, who's that bloke I've been doing a podcast with who bangs on about it all the time? You mean you'd never say it? That's the sort of thing I accidentally say if I'm having a discussion with my, and even as I'm saying it, I'm thinking, I've said the wrong thing here, haven't I? You know what I find interesting? Even as England made heavy weather of beating Andorra 4-0, they had the discussion, the commentator and Lee Dixon talking about, should Andorra even be playing the likes of England, etc., which, of course, they should. It's the World Cup. They're in the world. But it often strikes me, if you are going to have another tournament, then one in which Andorra, Bangladesh, the Maldives and Nepal can play each other, because I think they are players that would happily play. These are players that a lot of them are amateur or semi-professional. If you had a tournament in which they could take part and possibly win, I'd be all for that. But I'm guessing FIFA wouldn't be able to make money out of Bangladesh versus Andorra in a final of a tournament, so that's not going to happen.
We do have certain local tournaments, and it all comes down to ticket sales, commercial partners, and broadcast rights. Who's going to pay for Bangladesh versus Cook Islands?
Yeah, last season's mysterious swap deal between Barcelona and Juventus continues to unravel.
Yes, this is textbook creative accounting by both of those clubs. The two players involved are Arthur and Pjanic, who was a 30-year-old. I think he plays for Serbia or Croatia. They were involved in a swap deal between Barcelona and Juventus. And Arthur, who's decent, solid player, he went for a slightly eyebrow-raising £72 million from Barcelona to Juve. And Pjanic, who's, I was just gobsmacked. He's an okay player, 30-year-old player, so no real resale value. He went for €60 million, which allowed both Barcelona and Juve to publish or to produce huge profits on the deal. And Pjanic is now out on loan 12 months later. So he didn't make that much of an impression. He played on a regular basis, but Barcelona didn't have a good season. And it comes as absolutely no surprise. And this is all to do with the, if in a swap deal, how much is the value of the player? Well, it's a bit like, me selling you my book for £1 million and you selling me your book for 1.2 million. Mm. And we say, hey, we've just made an absolute fortune here.
Mm. That's true. That's not going to happen, is it, Kieran?
Not today.
Oh, okay. I'd need to sell you mine first to get the money to buy yours.
Yes.
So you have such credibility and integrity, Kieran. I was momentarily panicked by the thought that, how am I going to tell Ali this? Why have you got another copy of Kieran's book? It cost me £1 million.
But it's a rare unsigned version.
It's a rare copy of Kieran's book not seen in the background of any BBC interview. I love our final story, Kieran, for reasons that you'll discover. Froome Town's winner car draw had to be stopped after one person submitted thousands of entries.
Yes, yeah, and this is a hilarious story. It's also a very, very sad one. Froome Town, like many clubs in the lower leagues, desperate to raise money, and therefore they organised a prize draw where the first prize was a SsangYong Tivoli as a car, apparently. It's got four wheels, it wouldn't necessarily be many people's first choice, but it's a car, and it satisfies that for many people. But if you are having a prize draw, it is a legal requirement that you have to allow not just paid entries, and what Froome Town had done is it said if you make a £5 donation, that money will be split between the club and local food banks. And they got 450 people had entered. They were starting to raise some decent money, and then somebody turned up outside the club's office with 2,000 postcards, because you have to allow this free entry option as an alternative. So, yeah, they hadn't even bothered to post them because the price of a first-class stamp these days is outrageous.
Oh, tell me about it.
It's about 80 or 90 pence. It's absolutely shocking. I remember the good old days of my stamp collecting, and that I'm sure you've fallen off your chair knowing that I was a stamp collector, when the price of a first-class stamp went up from 2.5 pence to 3.5 pence, and that was outrage. I was outraged at the time.
Kieran, can I suggest that you may have got stamp collecting wrong? I'm pretty certain there's more to stamp collecting than just buying first class stamps and putting them in an album. You're supposed to go for stamps from other countries as well. We could all just buy a stamp and put that. Hey, what's that one? It's a first class English. No, okay. Right. So this person turns up with 2,000 postcards.
Yes, and of course, legally they have to accept them. But as soon as word got around, it meant, of course, that those people who were going through the donation route, when this went public, they're saying, "Well, what's the point of us giving us putting in for a £5 as a donation with a small chance of a winning when that is practically going to be a zero chance?" And some schmuck has completely abused the principle behind this draw. And therefore, the clubs had to cancel the competition, has refunded all the people that have put in the £5 donations. So the food bank has lost out as well. And it's a bit of a sorry story.
It is a sorry story, Kieran. I almost regret saying that I love it at the start. The reason I love it, and I've spoken to my friends about this, and nobody employed at Crystal Palace Football Club now was employed at Crystal Palace Football Club when this happened. So I feel I can share this story, Vicky. And back in 1987, Palace had an ongoing season-long competition where you could, for a certain amount of money, put your name in a draw and you could win a car. It was a larder. You could win a larder. So we all got a syndicate together, four of us, and lo and behold, amazingly, towards the end of the season, we won the car. We won the larder. Yeah, it was brilliant. Whereupon we all went down to the club, to the office, and the chap, the employee of the club, went, "Sit down, lads. This is a little bit awkward. Can we can we offer you the cash value of the car?" And one of them went, "Well, no, because he really needs a car, so we've decided that he can have that." He said, "Well, the thing is, we don't actually own the car." So we said, the car's been sitting on the touchline for every home game all season. He said, "Yeah, but we didn't think anybody would win it.
Oh,
we thought we had enough fans. We took a punt that nobody would ever win, and we don't. It's not our car, basically." So they offered us a cash equivalent, which we gratefully accepted, which is why there's a photograph. I'll send it to you. There's a photograph of us on the pitch standing by the car, grumpily holding up one of those giant cardboard checks that Paul's winners used to get.
That's brilliant.
I know. So I don't know. It's like, where did you, my mate said, why don't you use the money you give us? Instead of giving us the cash equivalent, use that to buy the car.
Yeah, I was thinking that. Yeah.
And they went, no, well, then we won't have a car for next year's draw. anyway, that's Froome Town, Crystal Palace feels your pain. Thank you, everybody, for listening. If you'd like to make a small contribution to our always free-to-air pod, then please go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. And if you have any questions for our regular Monday questions pod, then please email them to questions@priceoffootball.com. And in the meantime, I shall hand you over to Kieran McGuire for his customary farewell.
Well, once again, folks, thanks for the feedback. If you do enjoy the show and if you want to support us in any way, Patreon is great. The other way of doing it is to go on to that big purple Apple icon. Follow us there. And if you can give us 5 stars on a review, it helps the business side of things, according to producer guy. You can say whatever you want. You could say the show would be far better with Romesh and Julia Hartley Brewer as the presenters. I'd listen to that. But...
I'm sorry, Kieran, that came out of the blue. That was very random.
And it's... It helps us in the charts, and it helps us to negotiate with people who are guests on the show and so on. Other than that, look after yourselves and take care.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.